This is 4:55 on Friday, October 21st. All right.
Good morning. Welcome to a rainy, gray Friday morning with lots of people here.
People listening to the recording, you better be coming to class or there's going to be a mandatory attendance policy. Somehow extra credit for being where you're supposed to be doesn't seem like the right way to do this. Sticks for not being where you're supposed to be.
You could do both.
Yeah, and
yeah, I think that's perfect.
Yeah,
on the basis of changing the total structure of the available points in the class, everybody that was here minus a point, and then that got distributed for everybody that was
here.
Right. The same amount of total points available.
Who gets them? Okay. All right, let's get started. Andrew just made an interesting comment to me as we came in this morning that he found that the work in this chapter, chapter 4, on the bit strings was actually very helpful in understanding some of the stuff that happened in chapter 3 where he had to deal with hex. And that, at least for him, he felt like having done this work in chapter 4, he understood the chapter 3 stuff better. So I just offer that as one person's perspective on what's happened here, and I will consider it as something that might be helpful in the way that the earlier chapter is introduced, have a little more discussion of the bit format of numbers and so forth. Yeah, Andrew?
If the example to that would be long division versus short division, if the hex bit was, or the hex work was short division, the binary work was long division, and the short division didn't quite make sense without knowing what was going on in long division. Mm.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, sort of like that. I see that the later thing has sort of more of the foundation in it, and so things will make more sense if you understand the foundation, even though you could sort of do the mechanics of the other thing without the foundation. I like that people understand foundation. The other thing that came up this morning was, you may have read in the news, a distributed denial of service attack against one provider's DNS servers overnight. Sort of took down major websites. Well, it didn't really take them down, it just made them inaccessible to customers, things like Amazon and Netflix. Inaccessible because DNS servers could not be reached by customers in order to look up addresses, and so people would get server unknown messages when they tried to visit those sites. Don't know yet a lot about how it was accomplished or exactly what was done to mitigate it, but maybe by next week we'll know something. We can talk about that. That seems relevant. No, I don't think it was the root servers. It was the servers that were operated by a particular DNS provider, and so it was their DNS customers who became unreachable. It wasn't sort of globally based on the root servers. So it'll be interesting to see how the attack was carried out and what was done to put it to an end. The other thing that is interesting about it is that it took place at roughly 7 o'clock in the morning Eastern time, which didn't seem to me to be a particularly effective time from the perspective of, of the attackers. We don't know what their motivation was. Keegan mentioned to me that maybe the what was going on here was just a probe essentially, to find out whether something could be done with a with an intention to do something worse later, perhaps. So we'll figure that out and see what we can learn about that over the next week or so. Are there any questions? There is a homework. Now it's true. There's a homework due tonight, unlike when I did that before. I've gotten several of them turned in. Thank you. Somebody told me that the turn-in site wasn't working, so I fixed that a couple days ago. So thank you for that. Other questions? Good. All right. Well, we're going to finish up. We're going to finish up the routing lectures today, and then on Monday we will talk about the network programming using the select system call, which you'll need for the assignment, and also the receipt from, as well as some other tools that are useful for the assignment. They're not required. They're just useful things to know about. So we were talking about distance vector routing, and we talked about how when link costs change, the algorithm is actually pretty good, pretty fast at making the necessary changes to take advantage of that lower. If the cost goes down, take advantage of that lower cost. But that when the cost goes up, we may see this phenomenon that looks like counting to infinity or counting up to a much larger cost rather than getting there immediately. And we talked about this poisoned reverse trick, I would call it, that takes care of making that not happen, at least in some cases, but not in all cases. Essentially, what we do in that case is that if A sends to C through B, that A doesn't ever tell B that it has a path to C. Right? So A, the normal thing is A sends to B in order to get to C. But with poison reverse, and normally without poison reverse, then be telling B that it has a path of length such and such to C. Just so happens that that path already goes through B. And so if the cost goes up from B to C, then essentially what happens is B starts to think A is a good place to start sending traffic, and that's not true, right? Because A is just going to have to turn around and send it back to B. That never gets there. So poison reverse is just saying that A doesn't tell B that it has a good path, because it knows that B is the way it's going to use it. It had better not rely on A to do it. Anyway, you can see that in the book, and once you've implemented it in your program, it will be pretty clear what you have to do there. Okay, so I don't worry too much about what's on the left-hand side of this slide. What's on the right-hand side is actually pretty interesting, because if you think carefully through what it says, what happens if something is wrong in these protocols, right? You always have to worry about what happens if a router misadvertises something, message gets corrupted. Hopefully we can prevent that. So with link state routing, remember that's the one where everybody knows everything about the network. With link state routing, if a router advertises the wrong thing, what is it advertising? It's just advertising sort of its existence and the links that it's attached to. That's all it's advertising. And so and every other router will then sort of compute on the basis of that misinformation and maybe lead to sort of non-optimal paths. With distance vector, think about what a router is telling its neighbors. It's not telling its neighbors its local information. It's telling it
neighbors its picture of the global network, of the whole network. And so it's telling its neighbors about the paths that it has. If it does that wrong, then the neighbors will sort of act on that misinformation in a big way, right? And this has actually happened. Sort of back in the early days when the internet was much smaller, and this distance vector routing algorithm was being used more extensively. It's not used internet-wide at all anymore. It led to what was known as the black hole of the South Pacific, or some such thing. a site advertised that it had a great route, zero cost route to everywhere. Okay. So what does Linkstate do in that case? What does Distance Vector do in that case? It starts directing all the traffic of the whole internet into the South Pacific, where sort of flushes down the drain, you know, and so it's a major problem, right, with this, and a denial of service attack to the rest of the network. In that case, it was, I believe, a benign situation. There have been attempts
from various countries like China to do it intentionally and get their hand on as much traffic as possible.
And then there are sort of lower level attacks that do the same thing that the U.S. has actually carried out. They don't operate at the routing protocol at all, but rather they operate at the way that the network is configured at the lower levels so that all the traffic is going through Virginia. As much traffic as you can get is going through Virginia. And what can you do when as much traffic as you can get is going through Virginia and you keep up with it? You can look at it. And that's one way that you find out what's going on. You look at all that traffic.
So there's advantage to being able to see the traffic as it's going by. If you try to pull that off, you'd better be able to keep up with it. Otherwise, you have one of these black holes that everybody will be mad at you instantly, as opposed to being mad at you 5 years later when they found out that you did it and saw all that traffic. Okay. So the trick here to avoid pop-ups like that last one is, I believe, to do this. So let's talk about now another practical issue, which is that, we've talked about 4 billion hosts in the internet, possibly. And if you think about how many hosts are typically on a network. How many networks is that likely to be? Somewhere around 40. If there are 100 hosts per network on average, then it's something like 40 million networks. Right? And the picture that we've painted so far of both Linkstate and Distance Vector Routing is that every router knows about every network and has a route for every network. And does that work? 40 million knowledge about 40 million networks in every router. No. So, I think 600 million was probably the total number of hosts at the time that they did this. So you can't store everything in all the routing tables, and you can't exchange them. So the trick is what's called hierarchical routing. And that means that we group networks together in
what are called autonomous systems. So an autonomous system is a collection of subnets that are under common administration. And what we do is we use sort of detailed routing within an autonomous system, and then we use more summarized routing between the autonomous systems. And so sort of outside of your autonomous system, you don't have to know about nobody has to know about the details of your system. The consequence of this is suboptimal routing. If the world doesn't know the details of your network, then the world doesn't necessarily know the best way to get into your network. But that's a price we pay for the manageability of this. And there are different protocols that are used for inside the autonomous system, the so-called intra, remember the prefix intra means inside, intra-autonomous system routing protocols, and the inter-autonomous system routing protocols, inter meaning between, or the two. Within an AS, you can run whatever routing protocol you want. Between ASs, the internet has settled on a protocol called BGP, the Border Gateway Protocol, that deals with the routing between. Now, that's a nice picture, and it's a bit of a lie, as I've painted it so far. It's mostly true, but I've sort of glossed over something. The thing that I glossed over is that even within an autonomous system, the forwarding tables of the routers are affected by both the intra-AS routing algorithm and the inter-AS routing algorithm. So we've just sort of complicated our lives by saying every router has to run both the intra-AS protocol and the inter-AS protocol, because the inter-AS protocol is the one that's going to tell us how to get from somebody on this network to either one of these other autonomous systems. And so we actually have to do both things at every router, but we have a simplified view of the outside based on the inter-AS protocol. Okay, so the job of the inter-AS protocol is to tell the routers, say in AS1 here, what they're supposed to do with packets that arrive that go outside. And, you know, it's pretty clear that if 1D here, it's clear to us, looking from an omniscient viewpoint, it's clear that a packet arriving for AS2 here ought to be sent to 1B, right? We can see that. The question is, how do we build that into a protocol so that the router can build forwarding tables that will do that? Okay, so not too hard in this case. Right, we're going to figure out that this needs to go to 1C in the case of X. Where it gets interesting is suppose that X is reachable from either of these. Now, ideally, what would our ideal be? That the packet would take a path that had lowest cost. That would be our ideal. But that may not be what can be achieved in an efficient way as far as running the routing protocols itself. Okay. So the inter-AS protocol is going to have to tell 1D whether it should send this packet to 1C or to 1B.
So, going back, so this gets complicated, right? Because 1D needs to know 1C or 1B. The decision about that depends on the cost of getting to each of these, plus the cost of getting from these to here, plus the cost of getting from here to X, or plus the cost of getting from there to X. And what would be happening if we could actually tell 1C and 1D that information? Well, we would be running a non-hierarchical routing protocol. We wouldn't be hiding any information. We want to hide information. So, there are some heuristics that are used for this, and one of them is this so-called hot potato routing, which says that what we do within the inside the autonomous system is we just tell 1D that whatever network this is reachable through both routers. One needs to know that. But the decision that it makes about which one to use is which one of these is closer to it. Okay? So it just, on the basis of the very local information, chooses a router based on the cost of getting the router. Thus, the hot potato analogy, which is, you know, hand it a hot potato, give it to the closest person. Right? Get rid of it as fast as you can. And that's hot potato routing, which leads to my question, which I've already answered for you, but I want to emphasize it. What is being ignored when using hot potato routing? Pardon? No.
Oops.
No, not so much. Yeah.
Whether or not the other route is
better. Exactly. The goodness of the other route depends on information that you don't have. Right? And the other route may be better even though the cost of getting to it is a little higher to start with. So, yeah.
That's what I wanted you to think about. Okay. So that's hot potato routing.
Okay, so how does routing actually work in the internet? There are a number of different things. There are the intra-AS protocols, of which there are a handful, called RIP. You know, the one that I said that your router is most like is RIP. OSPF is a link state protocol that can be used intra-AS. And then there's this proprietary Cisco protocol called IGRP that I think is sort of designed more along the lines of the BGP that we'll talk about as the
inter-AS protocols.
So RIP, I'm not going to go through this in much detail because it's just like what we talked about for the abstract notion of distance vector and also what's happening in the project. But there are some engineering decisions associated with RIP that affect its usability. So, for example, the way the messages are defined in the protocol, it supports a maximum of 15 hops. Okay? So, if you had a really huge autonomous system, and an autonomous system can be really huge because, you know, think of a company, a worldwide company. They may have a worldwide network that they're using, and it could be actually quite large if they wanted to build their system that way. They might not build that as a single AS, but they might. If it got too large, you couldn't use RIP. Like our project, it has a timeout-based resending of information in addition to the triggered updates, and it sends advertisements every 30 seconds.
Okay, so where does 30 come from as opposed to 10 or 60? It's kind of an engineering decision based on the experience of people about how often link costs change. You know, it's pretty squishy where some of these numbers come from. And the protocol supports up to 25 destination subnets in a single advertisement. So 25 destination subnets. Again, if it gets too large, then you're going to have it's going to take a while to propagate all of the information in these advertisements. So
I don't want to go through this in detail, but I just want to point out that every instance of one of these algorithms will have decisions like this that have to be made, and where they come from is not always clear. Okay, so we're not going to do the RIP example because it's just like
before. The other problem is, what happens when a link goes down, and how do you finally find out that a link has gone down? Well, given when RIP was created, the links that were available at the time were pretty soup. They were essentially serial links with modems, and there wasn't any smarts in the link. So the link couldn't actually tell you whether it was up or down. These days we have you know, our cable modems and our DSL modems and our ATM backbone links. All of those links are capable of, at the link layer, determining whether they're functioning or not, and will report upward to the using layer if the link is up or down. That wasn't the case back in 1982. And so the RIP protocol itself has a mechanism for determining whether the link is working. And that is, if the link doesn't deliver one of these periodic advertisements within 3 minutes, 180 seconds, the link will be declared dead. And then it will go through the triggered update process that will propagate that information around the network. Okay, and it uses poison inverse. Any questions about this? Yeah?
What if the link becomes active again?
So when the link becomes active again, part of the rule is that you start getting the update messages, right? And so then you can start putting those back into your tables, into your disk inspectors, and that information will spread as well.
So it kind of automatically.
So it's automatic, absolutely. This already was realized back in 1982 that we couldn't have system administrators sort of having to take actions in response to these events, right? That it had to be automatic, and so it was. But there is something to say about this. So you remember that one of the comments about the link state algorithms was that they could oscillate. Remember that comment? They made it back when we first talked about it. It was on the summary slide too. Link state algorithm can oscillate. And I said when we first saw that, I don't think that's a property of a link state algorithm. That's not something that's particular to link state. I have observed in a network using a protocol that was essentially RIP. It wasn't an internet network, but it was. I mean, it wasn't an IP network, but it was essentially RIP. I have observed the situation where, due to congestion, the advertisements don't get through in a timely way. Okay. So what happens when advertisements don't get through in a timely way? The link gets declared. declared down. Right? The down information propagates. We don't use that link anymore. But now, since it's not being used anymore, the advertisements get through, and the link comes back up again, and immediately gets swamped with traffic, causing future advertisements to not get through again. And so you can definitely get oscillation even with this kind of protocol. It's not due in the way it was with described for link state due to changing cost. It's actually due to on the ground changing performance of the link. Whereas we sort of talked about before in terms of what if you were changing the cost as you assigned it. So anyway,
oscillations are definitely a problem. Yo-yo networks, sometimes called route flapping, is another term that you might hear, where routes go one direction and then shortly they go a different direction. You can sometimes see that phenomenon even today in trace routes, right? If you run a trace route, you may see points along the way where it says at a particular distance we had first this IP address and then that IP address and then some other IP address as those three probes for that distance go by. So, and it's not a problem as long as the packets are actually getting through. Right? It only becomes a problem if the packets are not. Okay, we're not going to talk about RIP table processing. You're going to essentially do that in the project. Okay, so the second intra-AS protocol is the so-called open shortest path first. The name open here comes from the early days of so-called open source software, and just means that it was a publicly available algorithm as in contrast to the Cisco proprietary one that was coming out about the same time. It's also a link state algorithm. What's cool about it? Being link state, the advertisements that a router makes go to all the other routers in the autonomous system, and I don't know how terribly relevant this is. The messages are carried in a special transport layer protocol. It's neither UDP nor TCP, but rather a transport layer that's designed for this algorithm. I do not know what IS routing is. I think it's a typo, but I don't know. All right. So let's think about security. What would happen if an attacker were able to substitute or add its own messages to a protocol like RIP that has no security? What could an attacker do? It could black hole. That would be one thing it could do. It could sort of actively send messages that says, I'm a great router. Okay. Send everything to me. Could do that. Could be malicious. So OSPF uses a sort of basic authentication mechanism based on secrets that are known by the authorized routers to make sure that others are not able to inject messages. Multiple same cost paths. So it's fancy. Right? It recognizes that for some purposes, some routes are better
and yet for other purposes, other routes to the same destination are better, and so it has a way to describe that. And it supports multicast, and we're going to talk about multicast a little later, so let's not worry about that right now. It also supports a hierarchical routing like we talked about before. Case there. Not going to do that in detail. All right, so within the RAS, you can use whatever routing algorithm you want. For inter-AS routing, the internet has converged on this protocol called BGP, Border Gateway Protocol. It's a very complicated protocol. I don't teach about it in any detail because the only people who really need to know about it in any detail are people who are working on inter-AS problems, and that's hardly anybody. So, you know, if you find yourself in the position of network engineer at a large company or an ISP, you're going to have to go and work for several weeks, I would say, to understand BGP. There's, you know, it's just huge. There's a lot of stuff in it. But what it does let us talk about is some of the issues that arise in routing between autonomous systems in the internet. So this is just a practical matter. The exterior BGP protocol has to do with how you learn information about other ASs. The interior BGP protocol is how you propagate that information into the interior network. Remember, we said that all the routers are going to have to potentially run both a intra-AS routing protocol and an inter-AS. So they sort of separated BGP into the two pieces. This is a very important one. Routes are chosen in BGP based on both reachability information and costs and on policy. And this policy thing is extremely important. Extremely important, and why BGP came to be so complicated. Consider this situation. We have three network providers. We have, that's A, B, and C, and we have three customers. And let's consider what happens when our customer is connected to two providers. So X is a customer, B and C are providers. We would not want, under any circumstances, or let's say X would not want, under any circumstances, to become the route between B and C. That would be just a really bad thing to have happen, right? Because X probably pays for the bandwidth that it gets from, that it downloads from B, and it pays for the bandwidth that it uploads to C, and you know they can both take advantage of X under that circumstance. So X needs to say, no, I am not willing to provide connectivity between B and C, even though I am connected to both of those, and potentially I could. I'm just not willing to. So that's a policy statement by X. Now, the way it works is that X just avoids doing the things in BGP that will allow B and C to see each other through X. From the outside. Inside of X, the routers need to be aware of connectivity to both B and C, because you know, sometimes B may be better, sometimes C may be better, and sometimes I may need to recognize that right now I can't reach B, and so I want to use C. All of that is possible. Similarly, B and C, you know, they want to be able to talk to each other and move move data between their customers who are not shown. But suppose that W is talking to, where are we up? X? Suppose that W is talking to X. Well, we wouldn't want C to be involved in that. Even though it could be, there's a path there. C should not be carrying traffic from W to X because, the story will be better if I use Y. Right? Because W to X can be done WACX, and that would be legitimate. And let's consider WACY. We wouldn't want that traffic to go WABCY. B should not be involved in that, not being paid to do that.
Okay, so BGP has ways to state and enforce these policies. Okay, so
takeaway. Scale, you've got to be able to scale up to essentially hundreds of millions of networks. Performance, within an autonomous system, we can sort of do whatever we want to have the performance that we want. But between autonomous systems, typically policy dominates network performance. And the way that you get performance is by choosing a good internet provider. You don't seek performance by sort of optimizing the paths of every packet, but rather sort of on a global scale choose an internet provider that can deliver the performance that you need to the places you need to go. All right. So, questions about this? Just recognize that there are these two different domains in which routing happens, and that the purpose of the algorithm is different and why the purpose is different between the two. Okay, so the next thing up is broadcast and multicast. What I'm going to do, since we have about 5 minutes left, is just introduce the topic of broadcast, probably, and why we... Just introduce the topic of broadcast. Now, broadcast doesn't actually happen in the internet. Think about it. Send a packet from your home machine and have it go everywhere in the world. But broadcast is a good stepping stone to talking about multicast. And multicast is actually interesting. So we'll get there. So here's the idea. Suppose I want to do broadcast. I want to send a packet from somebody up here attached to R1, somebody up here attached to R1 wants to send to everybody down connected to all of these routers. So the first thing you think about is, oh, let's have this machine up here make a packet for every one of those destinations, right? And so it sends that packet over and over and over again to all those destinations. What is the consequence of that? The consequence is that that packet being sent over and over and over again gets sent over and over and over again along all of these lengths and uses up a lot of bandwidth. And that seems silly, right? So the idea of broadcast is, let's send the packet once up here and have the network figure out when it needs to be duplicated, instead of having the source do duplication. That's this picture. So there's this inefficiency argument. The other difficulty with the source replication approach is that the source, in order to do what I just described, to send all the destinations, has to know about all the destinations. Right? That's a huge burden compared with what happens here, where the source sends once, and as it goes through the network, the things close to the destinations know about the destinations and make sure that the packet gets off. Okay, so those are the two big issues that lead us to want to have multicast ultimately, but described here in terms of broadcast. Right? So,
broadcast is essentially synonymous with in-network duplication from this point on. How does it work? Back here. How does it work?
So the first thing you think about is when a packet arrives at a router, which would be broadcast, send it on all of the links associated with that router. That's the first thing you think about. That's the so-called flooding algorithm. It has a few problems. So what sort of problem do we see here with flooding? Does this network will have a problem with flooding? Why? Anybody?
It exponentially duplicates.
Oh, it's worse than exponentially.
Yeah, it depends on how many is connected to other routers.
Well, it's forever it duplicates. Right? Because it comes in here, gets sent out both of these, as I've described it so far, it gets sent out both of these, and out both of these, and those arrive, and they get sent out all the interfaces, and now we have what's called a broadcast storm. The routers are making up packets. They're doing in network duplication, right, which is what they're intended to do. They're making up lots and lots of packets to the point that ultimately we fill up all those links. It's a very nasty situation. I've seen it happen. It happens with some of the link layer protocols, or it used to happen with some of the link layer protocols that are used for figuring out the solutions that prevent this at the higher level. And what happens when you have one of these broadcast storms is that essentially all of the routers and all of the links become 100% busy, which means that you no longer have any ability to control them except with the power switch. So broadcast storm can lock up a network completely to the point that you have to go around and turn things off in order to recover. Sort of like the congestion collapse that I referred to earlier at the network level, but this is the broadcast. So that simple
scheme doesn't
work. The simple flooding, controlled flooding, can help with this. You keep track of packets you've already broadcasted. You keep track of what you've already sent. And you don't send it again. Now, it still has an inefficiency.
Looking back here.
Still has the inefficiency that R3 will send to R4 and R4 will send to R3. And neither of those was a useful message. But at least it won't propagate further.
That way.
And then there's this so-called reverse path forwarding rule.
Look again at our picture. says we only forward a packet if it arrives on the shortest, on the link associated with the shortest path to the origin source. So how do we apply that rule in this case? Well, it's coming from R1. The shortest path to R1 is this link here, looking backwards from R3. And so we say, all right, we'll forward it if we get it on that link. But we would not forward it on this link if it came in on this link, because that's not on the shortest path to R1. Again, have to worry about what happens if there are ties and things like that. And again, it's inefficient if the traffic across this link is useless. Which leads us to what we'll start with next time, spanning tree. Okay? And so, once again, you've been very patient. Thank you. I owe you a couple of minutes at some point. A couple of minutes of your lives.